So let's, we could just start. Why don't, welcome to the show, Mick and Claire. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Maybe tell us who you are and what you guys do.
Got Mick's telling me to go first, which is a bit unfair. But anyway, so my name is Claire Daly. I'm with the great Mick Wallace. We're both Irish members of the European Parliament. We're not in a political party. We're independent members. And before that, we were members of the Irish Parliament, the Dáils. So we're kind of seasoned campaigners in a political sense, but we're over in Brussels at the moment.
Yeah, well, my name is Mick Wallace. And as Claire says, we're not in any party. We're independents. We adhere to the Groucho Marx school of philosophy. Groucho Marx says that he'd have nothing to do with any party that would even have him as a member.
But
having said that, we often accuse many of our, well, we used to accuse our opponents in the Irish Parliament of having a bit of the Groucho Marx political philosophy as well, because when the Groucho Marx said one time, he says, "I have my principles," he says, "and if you don't like him, I've more." So... so there's, we know plenty of politicians in Ireland and Europe that adhere to that philosophy.
We really do.
But
well, what's new about politicians that way?
No, they're probably getting worse. But anyway, we were elected twice in the Irish Parliament. We were elected in 2011 for a 5-year term, and then we were elected in 2016. And after 3.5 years of it, the second time round, the European elections came up, and we said, "Ah, sure, look at sure, we might as well give it a go." And there was only 11 MEPs for Ireland at the time. There's two extras since then because of Brexit. They divided out some of the English seats when England left.
That's so funny. What a hilarious revenge. All the things that the British, that the English did to you people, and you got their seats.
You should hear what the Germans got.
I go to a lot of football tournaments, right? But I was at the European Championships in England in 1996, right? Now, England is not a great place for European Championships because the fans wouldn't be my favourite, and not a good place for food or beer. But anyway, I was in a bar. I went to the semi-final between France and Czech in Manchester this day. And I was with two other Irish guys. And we're watching the match. We watched the game live in Manchester. But that night, England were playing Germany on television in the other semi-final. And we were going to go to the final. But we were in Manchester. So we watched the German-England game on TV. And there was about 500 people in the bar. And we were the only three in the place shouting for Germany. So at the end of course, the game went to penalties, and of course the Germans don't lose on penalties, right? So the Germans won. And these couple of fellas came over to us and says, "There's something we don't understand." And I said, "What don't you understand?" And he says, "I said, if Ireland were playing anyone but England, we'd shout for Ireland." He says, "England are playing Germany. How come you're shouting for Germany?" And my friend caught me by the shoulder and pulled me out of the way. And he says to your man, "Where were you for the last 800 years?
Exactly.
Anyway.
Anyway.
In fairness, yeah, we're not biased against English soccer teams. We don't care who beats them.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the purest joys in the world to see their heartbreak. So, but first, wait, before we start that Schadenfreude machine, can we back it up a little bit? Because Irish parliamentary politics has been in the global news. You know, a lot of parliamentary practices are kind of a lot of scenes that we get from sort of liberal democracies and the kind of electoral sort of machinations of them. What we see is a lot of theater, and you know, and that's fine, right? That's part of the machine. So this, from what I can tell, was an interesting piece of theater whereby some people in the Irish Parliament brought a proposal to expel the Israeli ambassador and a couple of other things, and then some viral videos went around of people making the case, and I for one was very excited by this, but Somebody in the know clued me in that this wasn't exactly how it looked and this was overstated the case. So maybe you can kind of explain to us what happened for all of us who don't follow the daily developments in the Irish Parliament.
Which one of us will go on this? Well, look, there's a couple of things there. I mean, the whole episode with the ambassador, I suppose it was a bit of good fortune in the sense that the Israeli ambassador happened to be invited into the Foreign Affairs Committee and was, I suppose, grilled and questioned in a very strong way by one of the left-wing members of parliament. And that then kind of took off in social media. I suppose more significant is, and which wouldn't be that theatrical, but actually is kind of real, that over a period of years, there would have been a lot of work done in the parliament, initiated firstly by one of the independent senators. And maybe this is why we can do things, because, again, this was somebody who wasn't in a political party. So a woman, Frances Black, had tabled legislation called the Occupied Territories Bill, which captured the imagination of actually a lot of people in Irish society. And in essence, what she did as a backbencher was to move this legislation to say that Ireland would ban products and goods produced in the occupied territories, not just in Palestine, but any areas where there were illegal settlements. So it wasn't targeted against Israel, but obviously because Israel, where it's internationally recognised, is where it would have most applied. And the Israelis themselves sort of got really up in arms with this legislation. It made its way through a lot of stages in the parliament with a lot of backing, but some of the bigger parties refused to see it through, I suppose, when there was a change of government. But this was there in the background with majority political support. And I think because it was quite a strong statement and it was kind of could be reignited on the statute books, it gave a certain oomph to what was going on in the parliament that you had that legislation there, I suppose, and you had the background on it. I don't know. What do you, that was more meaty, I think, having that there than the ambassador stunt.
Yeah, but I suppose, as you know, I mean, we did actually manage to agree on something in the parliament, in the Irish parliament last week. We weren't there, but there was a declaration agreed cross-party right across the board in the Irish parliament, which declared that Israel's actions amount to unlawful de facto annexation of that territory of Palestine. Now, and we were the first European member state to actually go to that point with it. Now, the larger parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, or the Greens, I mean, at the moment, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, which are the two traditional right-wing parties in Ireland, they're in government with the Greens, who are probably behind the right-wing side as well. But they were never really going to agree to expel the ambassador. But what we did get was a great achievement. And for Simon Coveney, who is the Irish foreign minister at the moment, I mean, he was actually, of the 27 foreign ministers in the European Union at the moment, I would have to say, and God knows, we wouldn't be agreeing on Simon with everything, because he is closer to the US position. They still allow the US troops use Shannon for military purposes, which we have protested very strongly about. And they generally adhere to the sanctions regimes as well that the Americans introduced and that have been followed by many of the Europeans. But on this particular occasion, Simon was, he seemed genuinely angry that this was just too much and the Israelis had gone too far and Ireland were prepared to take a position on it, and which has definitely to be commended. So he deserves a lot of credit for that. As we said, we wouldn't agree with him on much, but we'd be very conscious of what he would face when he comes to Brussels and sits down. I mean, you were asking us about the European Parliament earlier there before we came on air, but the European Union is a sort of, it's a strange bag, and it isn't very democratic, but we have a parliament, we have a commission, and we have a council. The parliament are elected directly by the people from the various countries. The commission are unelected, just appointed by the various big groups in the parliament, so they're not elected. And the council is where, for example, if there was a full council meeting, the prime minister for each of the 27 countries would come along. If there was a foreign affairs council meeting, the foreign affairs minister for each of the 27 member states would come along. And we would know pretty well what Simon would be facing when he would arrive in Brussels and face the other 26 foreign affairs ministers who have been predominantly pro-Israel, predominantly pro-American, Atlanticist, completely in their thinking. So for him to even take the position he did was a major achievement.
There is this there does seem to be a kind of natural affinity between, let's say, a certain sort of corner of like sort of Irish history and sort of Irish, I guess if we could say that, like Irish sort of struggle against specifically English imperialism, British imperialism, and the struggle of the Palestinians. Like it's well known. There's a lot of camaraderie, and there were obviously links earlier in previous generations of Palestinian, specifically guerrilla warfare. There were real, I mean, sort of institutional connections between them and sort of Irish equivalent sort of Irish groups. So there is obviously a connection there, And it's not hard to see. It obviously has a relationship to the British Empire and the experience of partition and the experience of colonial subjugation. Now, can you map the history of Palestine onto the history of Ireland? No, obviously. It's completely different. It's a completely different beast. But I guess in some ways, is this episode and what it could achieve, at least nominally, one of the sort of tangible benefits of establishing the sovereignty of Ireland? Like this sort of the place that, you know, you guys, you know, like Irish republicanism got us to this place. However, Ireland is like a member of the EU, right? Like, so is it a weird position to be in vis-a-vis, like, you do have this kind of empathetic connection to the sort of classic underdog, but on the other hand, you're also part of, like, you know, the imperial core in a way, if a somewhat periphery member. Is that fair to say? Sorry, did I just insult Ireland?
Oh, far away. We do it all the time. Don't worry about it. And I suppose, like, if Simon Coveney, the foreign minister, was listening in here now, and he'd probably be saying he himself isn't an Irish Republican. So I suppose there's so much issues that you touched off there. I mean, I think you're totally right. I think the empathy that Irish people feel for Palestine runs deep. And there's no doubt that it is connected with our colonial past. I think the connections between, say, the IRA campaign, which was largely based in Northern Ireland, and their links with the PLO at the time and the other struggles in Palestine, while that was a certain institutional link, that wouldn't be embedded in the hearts and minds of Irish people, if you like. So the empathy goes right across the political establishment. It's kind of, to me, I would see it as coming back to even our time in World War II. We were one of the few countries that remained neutral and we didn't take sides. And Ireland paid a heavy price for that later on in the Marshall Plan years and so on. Ireland didn't get any of the benefits because we didn't side with either of the camps. So I suppose it is an unusual position. I think we do stick up for the underdog, and we're now here, a proudly sovereign nation. I think a lot of people are proud of being our own country, but we've kind of subjugated ourselves in the EU. It is very much a neoliberal project where Ireland is a tiny member, and we tend to bow the knee, on the one hand, to the EU establishment, who also bends it to the US. So we've kind of traded our British colonialism for US colonialism, where we've become dependent on US investment and multinationals, and they're afraid to do anything that sort of rocks that boat. That's why we allow our civilian airport be used by the US military, even though we're supposed to be a neutral country. And when anybody speaks up about that, they say, oh, the jobs and the multinationals. So I suppose coming against that backdrop and knowing the US's support for Israel, it's a bit even more significant in some ways that Ireland has made the stance that it has on Palestine, and particularly as it's out of kilter with a lot of the bigger countries in Europe. You know.
Yeah, first point you raised about there's a sort of a natural affinity anyway, though, among the Irish for an underdog. Just to give you a brazen example of it, when myself and Claire stood for the European elections, the mainstream media would probably have very rarely have said anything positive about us and would have been writing negative stuff most of the time about us. But the Irish people don't like that. And we got overwhelming support from the people, not from the media, but from the people. And we, with only 11 MEPs representing the country, we got two of them. And another independent got another one of them. So there was three independents out of 11. And that's not something you see much even in Europe. But as Claire said, while we got rid of the Brits, unfortunately, we've become subservient to American capitalism, to the US imperialist goals. And we have protested vehemently for a number of years about the Shannon Airport being used as a US military base. And you'd be interested to hear that after we were actually arrested for breaking into it in order to search a US military plane a few years ago. And we organized an opinion survey as to whether the Irish people were in favour of Shannon Airport being used as a US military base or not. Now, we even had difficulty getting the question asked in a way that would lead even to a straight answer. It was almost a leading question to encourage people to say, oh no, we're grand with the Americans. And there's such pressure in Ireland because of the foreign direct investment, because we don't do indigenous industry ourselves apart from farming. So we're dependent on these jobs from these American companies who pay bugger all tax in Ireland, but do provide jobs. But the result of the survey put, there was around 60% of the people were against Shannon Airport being used as a military base. I mean, this is, and this, you're talking a conservative island, right? Ireland has never been a wild revolutionary place, really. And there's a lot of conservative aspects to it. But yet, at the same time, they really value their independence and it means something to them. And I think it's easy for the Irish to have an affinity with the Palestinian cause. It's kind of in black and white for us. The Palestinians, we see that in 1947-48, they got thrown out of their houses, 800,000 of them. Their land was taken from them. And they were thrown into an area where it was literally a refugee camp now. And now they've started throwing them out of those houses. I mean, it's not difficult for the Irish to feel for the Palestinian. And while we've got our independence now 100 years, right? But there was housing was a huge issue for a couple of hundred years in Ireland. Even it's a problem now. But back when we had the British colonialists running the show in Ireland, housing was a big problem. And there had been a lot of small holdings on land right across Ireland. And people used to kind of work with the local landlord in return for being allowed to stay in the house. Sometimes they might pay rent, sometimes not, depending on how much work he was doing for the landlord. But there was with changes in agriculture, a whole lot of the landlords cleaned off the land and they literally knocked down the houses and put people out of their homes in order to make the land, make the fields bigger and open up spaces to suit changes in agriculture at the time. So the Irish people, those stories about being thrown out of your house and left on the side of the road haven't gone away. They've been passed down generation to generation. So it's not unlinked to how we feel about the Palestinian cause today.
I think that's a good point, actually. Small farmers being driven off their land, and that Irish people would have a real affinity with that. And it is pretty black and white for us. I think maybe one of the things that doesn't get commented on either was we've a real proud history of peacekeeping. So we've a small army. Wouldn't be much point having one, because if anyone invades us, we're kind of finished anyway. So it doesn't really work.
We'd be better off invite them to the pub for a pint.
Absolutely. So there really is no point in having it. But what we are really good at, and we used to be kind of internationally recognised for it, is peacekeeping. And there's always been a strong Irish presence in that area, in Lebanon, in the Israeli and occupied Golan Heights and so on. People know Israel's antics in that area, I think, through the presence of our peacekeepers in Lebanon previously in that area. And I think that possibly has something to do with it as well.
I mean, there is a historical question that a lot of because Ireland is a small country, right? We're talking, 4 million people? And then how many in Northern Ireland?
5 million in the Republic now and 1.6 in the north.
Like, is the current sort of configuration of the Irish Republic, like vis-a-vis Europe as a kind of member of the European Union and as home to a lot of sort of transnational capital, a sort of happy, friendly host to a lot of transnational capital. Meanwhile, once a year, you know, everybody sort of dances and pretends to be Irish and you know, gets drunk. And it seems to me like a tragedy that, like, this is the fate of sort of Irish history. Like, there's so much struggle, like so much, like decades of like peasant revolt. I guess my question today, and I guess you guys are the right people to ask it because of where you work, but like, what is political sovereignty today in a world of, you know, mass multinational capital? How does a small country live sovereign without resorting to, you know, basically opening up your economy for whatever, you know, parasite class shows up?
Well, I suppose on the size of Ireland, and it's a point we used to always make when we were in the Irish Parliament. I mean, we're a tiny country, but actually we punch way above our weight. Like, I don't know if that's because we're mouthy or whatever, or we like to socialise and have a few drinks. But like, the Irish are known all over the world. And we've always said that our neutral position could have been harnessed in a very positive way to, you know, have an influence beyond our size. But I mean, you're totally right that our revolutionary history has been lived upon and brokered for years, really. But people in the last decades have been living a lie, because that history of struggle was really betrayed. Like when James Connolly fought in the 1916 Rising, and he made the point that if you just replace the flag over Dublin Castle, and it's a landlord wearing green who's evicting you out of your house, or it's a boss who's sacking you and he has an Irish name, it doesn't really matter. You have to tackle the roots of that. And sadly, that's what happened. There was a really weak Irish capitalist class took the reins and quickly sold themselves to US imperialism and big multinationals. And then latterly, that was replaced by joining the European Union, which was the EEC in the early years. And Ireland joined because England was joining. Let's be clear about it. And we were completely linked to the British economy at that stage. So now we've become subsumed in part, on the one hand, by the US, and on the other, by the European Union. And it's a, it is a complicated relationship, I suppose, because itching to get in here now, go on.
No, I wasn't. Don't mind her. I suppose if you ask the Irish people today, are you in favour of being the European Union? Yeah. 9 out of 10 will tell you, yes, we are. But at the same time, we would say that mainstream media don't cover the goings on in Europe very well. I mean, we don't really have what we would call an independent media. They're very much part of the status quo, very much part of the establishment. They back up our successive right-wing governments all the time. But the truth is that you ask, can we have sovereignty within a group of 27 member countries in Europe, and also with our close ties to America? Well, our sovereignty has been watered down. We would feel that we were more independent in the past. Claire says we punch above our weight. I would say in European Union, nobody punches above their weight. The Germans and the French run the show with the connivance of a few of the other wealthy states like Holland, Austria and Finland and all. But the Germans are really top dog, and they call the shots. Ireland has a very small say in the matter. Now, when we joined the EU all those years ago, one of our strongest assets was our fishing, because we were an island and there was an amazing resource of fish around Ireland. Well, we gave that up, and the French, the Spaniards and the Portuguese factory ships have been hoovering the fish off our island ever since. And our small fishermen, most of them have been driven out of business. But we gave that up in return for subsidies for dairy farmers. So to such a point, and we were talking about small farms being driven off the land, small farmers being driven off the land back in the 19th century and earlier. But in actual fact, you might be shocked to hear that in the last 60 years, Ireland has lost 140,000 small farms. And the dairy industry is the main gobbler of that. And that's something that was driven by the EU. The EU, as Claire said, is a neoliberal club. It puts the interests of big business before those of the citizens. And we would see many challenges with how it operates. And we see a lot of problems coming down the tracks unless it changes its ways. If it doesn't start representing the people, the citizens. And I mean, obviously, the Brits left. And there's a lot of talk about as to why did they really leave. But I mean, the truth of the matter is, and it wasn't just because they were anti-immigrant, because not all the British people in general, there's probably more mixed race in Britain than there is in most countries. And most people in Britain are actually pretty good at dealing with people from different nationalities and entertaining them and working with them. But one big factor with the Brexit vote, which all the predictions got wrong, was the fact that the poor, and when pollsters go out, they generally can't measure the thoughts of the poor, what way are they going to vote, because they don't actually reach them, even with their polls. But the poor, an awful lot of poor people said, you know what, I usually don't even vote, but you know what, I'm going to vote this time because my vote could matter. And they, as far as they were concerned, politics didn't serve them. The European Brussels didn't serve them, but of course neither did London. And they said, fuck yous. And they gave them the two fingers and they voted for Brexit. Now, unfortunately, as I said, While Brussels wasn't serving their interests, we would also argue that London won't either. Yeah. But that's a different problem coming down the tracks.
No, there is a huge disconnect between the citizens right across Europe and the European institutions. But I'm just coming in because you misquoted me there, saying that I said Ireland punched above its weight. I said Ireland could punch above its weight if it behaved properly.
Well, if it was any consolation to you, not the first person I've misquoted.
The proof of that is the stance taken on the annexation of the lands and that as well, because it sent shockwaves. The Israelis were totally apoplectic about the Irish Parliament taking that decision. So what I'm saying is, even a small country can have an influence, but once you're in the European Union, you lose your sovereignty, because it's wedded into the treaties that neoliberalism must prevail. You've got to keep your budgets in line. You've got to impose cuts. We took the burden of the European banks. But when the Irish people are asked, do they like Europe? They love Europe. They can't get enough of it. They think it's great. But actually what they think is great is this idea of being able to travel, have your kids educated, speak a different language. That's what they think Europe is. But actually it isn't. It's an increasingly institutionalized big agri, big industry, big tech, and the arms industry driving an agenda, and increasingly being led by the US and developing a very dangerous anti-China, anti-Russian rhetoric daily. You know, shocking.
So you two have done a remarkable job, like, I guess the only way I can call it, kind of breaking the discursive blockade around a lot of foreign policy matters. I mean, I don't, maybe also on local issues in Ireland. I'm not really tuned into that, obviously. But when I see you guys online, you're, you know, oftentimes it's talking about the policies of the EU or critical of the American imperialism. So, you know, you guys have harnessed your outsider independent position for a lot in terms of breaking the status quo, in terms of discursively, like saying things you can't say. And I guess basically, you know, your explanation of what happened in Ireland is that even if this attempt to do this symbolic act failed, the very act itself is a measure of the incredible sort of solidarity that exists, that like undergirds a lot of maybe institutional political politics, if not Ireland sort of people as a whole. So that I understand is kind of, those have their own value. And I don't think I'm not the kind of person now that it's like, well, since this thing failed, it was kind of meaningless, but like a lot of this is theater. So you guys also have your own media machine, right? You guys host a podcast. You guys are often traveling and going on delegations. Is this the job of an independent MT? Is this just to kind of do your own thing and kind of like throw a wrench into the sort of machine of normal neoliberal business?
Well, I suppose we've always viewed elected positions. I mean, what's the point in getting elected somewhere if you're going to just use that position to keep the status quo? Like, the whole idea when people say they start getting involved in politics is to try and change things. Well, I suppose we never grew up, or we never lost that. Like, that's what we're here to do. So we don't want to be nodding donkeys. And once you're in an elected position, it's harder for, you know, the media to ignore you. You do have a voice, and with that comes a responsibility. So I suppose we've taken international affairs very seriously. When we were in the Irish Parliament, like, we visited Syria a couple of times because we found, like yourselves, you know, a lot of people on the left lost their way over Syria, you know, and kind of didn't understand what was really going on there. So we would have been to Syria a few times. We would have been to Iran. We've come back from Iraq recently. So I suppose we go to the places that the European institutions are always given out about, in order to bear independent testimony to what is going on there and to try and tell the truth. And yeah, I mean, we're well known in Ireland. I suppose we're getting better known in Europe. We do have a podcast. We brought out a book about our escapade into invading the runway in Shannon Airport to try and search US military aircraft, which gives a whole history of Ireland's neutrality, and it's a pretty good read as well. But yeah, I mean, that's our job, isn't it? To hold power to account, to try and stir things up, get people thinking. So,
yeah, when we decided to stand, we were actually criticised a lot by our own supporters, and they said, "Please don't go, please don't go." And we said, "Well, no, listen, we think we can have an impact in Europe, you know." But the people at home would be familiar with the fact that there's very little media coverage of what goes on in Europe, in Ireland. So a lot of people in Ireland today wouldn't know much about what we've been up to for the last 2 years since we got elected to Brussels. But we did say at the time that, yeah, we have serious issues with the how the European Union was working. And we said, look, we're going over there and we will try to change it. We will try to make it an institution that serves its citizens rather than serves big business. And we said, if we can't change it, we'll burn the place. So that's still a work in progress. And I mean, you can argue that there's 705 MEPs here now, I think, right? And it's of course it's difficult for two independents to make a massive impact. But we would say that, I mean, we speak probably more often than anybody. We speak at committees a lot. We speak in the plenary a lot. We like to think that we call a spade a spade. We try to be straight and we're not afraid. And we just want to speak the truth and we want to stand up for people who are not being treated fairly. We want to expose what's happening because everything that's happening in other parts of the world is linked to what we do in Ireland, what we do in Europe. Like, for example, I mean, obviously I'm on the Environment Committee as well, and I don't want to start going into that, but there's huge connections between how we're still European countries, and many of them are still behaving like colonialists. Like, for example, in the Sahel, in the Sub-Sahara in Africa. It is frightening what the likes of the French are doing. That they're literally French electricity, 75% of it is from nuclear, and all the uranium for French nuclear is coming from that Sahel region. They're literally robbing the place blind, and they give up about African leaders being corrupt, but it's the Europeans that have made them corrupt. They bribe them in order to get what they want from them. The Europeans very often decide who gets into power. But I mean, this is going on, and it's linked to how our carbon footprint as well as our moral footprint, and all these things are tied together. And as Claire mentioned about Syria, we've actually been to Syria twice and we're going again pretty soon, right? I mean, one thing, for example, in Ireland that we would be critical of is that the Irish people haven't made the connection between the Palestine, between Syria, between what's happening in Iran, what's happening in Yemen. These things are all, there's a link between all these, right? And people in Ireland, because the media did such a good job of telling so many lies and using the Syrian Observatory and the White Helmets as a source of information when they were actually working with the jihadists, I mean, the mainstream media at home have told such an untrue story about Syria that one of our challenges is to help people to understand that all these things are linked, and the treatment of the Syrian people is linked to the treatment of the Palestinians by the Israelis, and the manner in which Western powers, the US, European member states, the Saudis, UAE, and Israel, the way that they actually arm terrorist groups in order to destroy Syria. That's a story that hasn't been told at home. It hasn't been told in Europe. It hasn't been told by the people, the members of the European Parliament. But yet, at the same time, they're pushing a war agenda now. There's a huge increase in the militarization of Europe. And the MEPs stand up in the Parliament and advocate for this morning, noon and night. But it's not what the European people want. Mm. The European people don't want to be fighting with Russia. They don't want to be fighting with China. We want to work with them. We want to work with people. And we're not saying that they're any better or worse than anyone else. But I mean, this whole rhetoric now, this anti-Russian and anti-China rhetoric that's going on here, it's disconnected from reality. But unfortunately, and the ordinary citizens of Europe, they see through a lot of this. And they do, and from our point of view, the members of parliament, the MEPs that were elected by the people, but they actually don't represent them an awful lot of the time.
No, there's huge numbers of people who wouldn't even vote in European elections and that as well, you know. But yeah, no.
Well, that's actually something I wanted to bring up because, you know, you two are a different generation than me. I'm a child of neoliberalism. I've grown up watching media conglomeration, vast growth in like, not just like on the one hand, like sort of personal debt and inflation and like cost of living. On the other hand, sort of massive decline in jobs and earning potential. Every politician and every party is corrupt, useless, evil, war criminals, like colonizers. I voted once in my life. I'm approaching my fifth decade on the planet. And it was like for a communist who got like 8 votes. The idea of even finding out who my local representative is, I laugh. Like, I would rather like do anything on the planet than go and track down my local political representative. Like, what for? Like, I could literally spend better time like cleaning my tub. Like, anything would be more productive. What do you say to me? Like, what do you say to the guy like who doesn't give a shit? Like, maybe I would have voted in Brexit. Honestly, if I was in England, I would have voted yes for Brexit for the exact reason you said. Even though I'm not a poor person, I'm a middle class person, educated, whatever, I would have voted it just as an indictment of the political class and of the political status quo, which what I can tell, it was mostly that. Right? So, you know, what do you say to like the apathetic, you know, millennial non-voter? Like, who says, like, go get stuffed. I don't want to talk to you people. You've done nothing for me.
Well, you'd be totally right in doing that. I mean, democracy is highly overrated. We have in the European Union them waffling on about democracy all the time. But actually what it is for a lot of them is you get the right to vote once every 5 years for a bunch of liars who come in and do the complete opposite or do absolutely nothing. Yeah. So why wouldn't people be disillusioned by that? And as I said earlier, a lot of people who get into politics do it as a career, which I think is a terrible word. They're kind of nurtured in these schools for just to perpetuate the status quo. But I suppose our thinking is that actually politicians don't change things. It's ordinary people who change things, organizing themselves. We got a little bit of a glimpse of that on a European scale with the movement of young people around the issues of climate change, which really put the need to deal with climate change center of the European agenda. The whole Greta Thunberg young people's movement actually resulted in getting a load of green people elected to the European Parliament. Now, a lot of them are a bunch of absolute wasters who won't deliver anything on climate change, but it shows they had to respond to the people from below. And that's how change really happens, is up against the people who are elected, not really the people who are elected leading, but rather they follow a movement. So what we encourage people to do is organise themselves collectively. I mean, there were a few examples of political groupings that emerged in Europe over the last number of years, but a lot of them met with a sort of a, you know, in response to the austerity. You had new formations, Podemos in Spain, Syriza in Greece, these organizations which said they kind of the five-star movement in Italy. They said they weren't left or right, but they were more a bottom-up people's movement. None of them really turned out like that. They kind of disappointed in the long run, I suppose, or maybe the long run isn't even here yet. But
I mean, they put the word hope under Obama's face, so that's what we know false prophets.
It's just so all politics. I mean, that is gut-wrenching, and I mean, it's so difficult in the States that, you know, our hearts go out to you. It's not easy, you know. We think our politicians are bad. They're even worse there because they're all the same. But then at the same time, you see the movements around Black Lives Matter. You see people trying to find ways to break through. And I know you haven't really got anybody on the, I suppose, elected platforms who are seriously any good, really. You know, there's a few who are okay, like, but they're not even great, you know. But, you know.
When Bernie Sanders recognized Guaido as the president of Venezuela, we knew he's
the great white hope.
We knew you were in real trouble.
Yeah,
and it was theatrical for us to hear the likes of the New York Times almost calling Sanders a communist, but in actual fact, if he was in Europe, he'd be considered right of centre, a good bit right of it. But just on the issue of, you know, what would we say to people that are totally disillusioned with politics and say, why the hell should I bother voting? Well, just to bring it back home to Ireland, where obviously we'd be most familiar with, there's a big problem in that. You're right, the apathy is frightening, right? And as Claire said, politicians never change the world, the people do. And very often the people have to force the politicians to make better decisions. But in Ireland, for example, there was a big move. As you know, we had a banking crisis in 2008-09, and we bailed out the banks at the behest of the European Union because most of the money was owed to German and French banks, and they wanted their money back. So they forced us to take loans, and they made the people pay the bill. these were useless banks that shouldn't have been saved, and it was an absolute waste of time even rescuing them. But and the burden was placed on the people. They called it austerity. They've actually banned the word now because they do the same thing, but they call it something else. But one of the measures that they were trying to bring in as part of recovering the money with austerity was they wanted to charge for water. Right now, the Irish people, we knew that we were paying for our water through general taxation all along. It was never coming free from the sky, right? It was coming out of a tap and it had to get there somehow. But general, it was done through to general taxation. Ireland tried to bring it in many years ago. I think it was 96. And there was opposition to it at the time. And what they did instead was to buy in the most draconian motor tax in Europe instead of getting the money for the water. And they got away with it. But this time now they wanted the money for the water as well. So there was we knew that the people in Britain were paying £700 and £800 sterling a year to get water. And the Irish people weren't very keen on that idea. And obviously there was opposition from the more left-wing groups in the Irish Parliament to it. But what really happened was a grassroots movement started, not started by any of the politicians. Mm. Now, obviously, many of us got involved in it, but this was a grassroots movement started by the people. It actually reached a point where it was impossible for the government to bring it in. There was such opposition to it. And the government went through all the hoops of the legislation, the whole lot, and they were doing this, they were doing that, and how they were doing it. And they even started putting in the meters. The fellas putting in the meters found it even difficult to work. There was such just citizens' involvement on every footpath every morning. It was just massive. And it was a wonderful demonstration of people power. Fantastic. It was really, it was so impressive. And you ask, okay, how can we change things? Well, in Ireland today, 65% of the people generally vote. The 35% that don't, they wouldn't vote for those right-wing parties. And we got our independence over 100 years ago, and we've had a right-wing party every year since of those 100 years, a right-wing party every goddamn year, right? But unfortunately, a third of the people who don't vote wouldn't actually vote for them, right? Now, on top of that, in the last two general elections in Ireland, the people under 26 years of age, only one in five voted. Now, that is criminal. The young people in Ireland have the potential to change the way they're governed. And it's a message that we've tried to get out to them. It's hard to convince them. There's such a general apathy about politics because politics has let down the people so much. But it is 100% true that the young people, the same as Claire related to, they've made a difference on environment, even though I would argue that the changes are not coming like they should in the European Parliament because big agri is still calling the shots. Big business is still going to make too many of the big decisions, and they're kicking the can down the road on most of the real important environmental issues. But the young people have made a difference there, and they can make a difference in what constitutes every parliament across Europe as well as the European Parliament, but they've got to engage.
So we've gone on for almost an hour. I won't keep you for much longer. I do have a question about kind of, this is a big, big fat global question, which is the kind of center of political, sort of geopolitical power is moving, right? Europe is facing a crisis in terms of its orientation towards the United States for going on seven, eight, is going to radically change as American power declines, as its own sort of hegemony fades, and obviously China sort of asserts its own sort of global, let's say, I don't want to say global world order, because that's too dramatic, but the American way of doing things isn't going to be the only show. And it's going to be interesting, what does a country like Ireland do to confront that? Is it a perverse thing to say that like Brexit might be a good idea for someone like Ireland, and to nationalize your economy, to assert more food sovereignty, to, you know what I mean, to reverse the kind of neoliberal gains? Because it's hard to imagine a scenario where Ireland remains beholden to Brussels institutionally, politically, economically, you know, even in terms of, I guess, foreign policy, whatever that means. But like, and also retain any kind of sort of national, I don't know, sovereignty over its own, you know, resources and stuff like that, as you guys have expressed. So is this the weird future that Ireland like should pursue? I mean, I don't know. That's an impossible thing to ask you guys. members of European Parliament. Like, should they fire you? Should they get you, delete your jobs and like return to their national sovereignty model? Is this a potential solution to the coming crises?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think Mick made the point. We said we'd come here to see could we change, and if not, we'd burn it. Let's just say we've bought a couple of matches recently, you know?
They're just speaking figuratively, folks. Please, please don't arrest them. It's a metaphor. The matches are a metaphor.
How do you spell that?
Yeah, but now I'm after losing my train of thought now after that. Of course it was a metaphor, but...
Well, okay, I'll pick it up when you get back, right?
Okay,
On the issue of sovereignty, right? Yeah. As we said, right now, 9 out of 10 people in Ireland want Ireland to stay in the European Union, but they're not really joining the dots, right? They're probably not comprehending for the fact, for example, that us allowing Shannon Airport to be used by the American military to bomb people's homes and create refugees in other regions isn't a great idea. They have a big problem with farming, with food, right? Our farmers have been driven out of business. They can't compete with the trade agreements that are killing farmers in Europe. You can import a kilo of carrots that are washed and bagged to be sold in a supermarket in Ireland for about 35 cents, right? An Irish farmer can't produce them for that, right? So there's huge issues at play in Ireland. Because of the neoliberal nature of Europe and of Ireland, we've a huge problem with the supply of housing. So not just food, we've a huge problem with unregulated banks. We've a huge problem with facilitating the interest of big business before those of the ordinary citizens in Ireland. And while no one says that there's a mafia in Ireland, the manner in which big business operates in Ireland, and myself and Claire would have exposed some of this in our time in the Irish Parliament with a bad bank called NAMA has been part of it, right? But the manner in which big business operates in Ireland is like a mafia, only they're not called a mafia. So there is huge... Ireland is becoming... while it's a wonderful country and we love it to bits, I think it's becoming a more difficult country for young people to stay in and to start a life and to raise kids in. And that's a big challenge.
And it's a challenge for a lot of countries across Europe. I mean, Ireland can't be sovereign in Europe. We don't have control over our own currency. The treaties of the European Union are embedded in neoliberal regulations. So we got to keep our budget figures within a certain criteria. We're not allowed to borrow money to spend. Austerity is kind of enshrined in that. So to break free from that, you'd have to change the treaties of the European Union. But, you know, they got a fright over Brexit when the UK left. Obviously, countries like Italy and that are could leave. Other countries could. The breakup of the European Union could be posed. It's probably more likely that will be posed than it can be reformed, because it can't be reformed based on the treaties that it is now. But your points about the shift in global world order are really significant, and we experience that on a daily basis here. And maybe in some ways it's a bit like the United States in the role of the dying snake. The bite of the dying snake is the most venomous, and we have now a massive influence being put on the European Union to break its trade links with China. There's a growing Russophobia, which is beyond all semblance of reality. It's just ridiculous. But yet you've the contradiction that the EU's biggest trading partner now this year is China for the first time ever. So you have that contradiction there. And Ireland as a small country is caught up in that. So we have a real hostility being displayed to China and Russia. But then at the same time, business deals going ahead despite the sanctions, which are being ratcheted up as well illegally. It's quite a complex period.
To go back to the position of the European citizen, right? I mean, while we have MEPs prepared to mount the American line that China is a threat to American security and then European, well, in actual fact, China is not a threat to either's security. There's no Chinese warships off the coast of America. There is American warships and some European down in the South China Sea. The Chinese haven't bombed anyone in 40 years, right? The Chinese are not a threat to their security. It's only a threat to their financial supremacy, which has been in place for close to 100 years. And that's what's changing. But the citizens of Europe are not stupid. And the citizens of Europe can see that there's no merit in us falling out with China. There's no merit in us falling out with Russia. And sure, we've no problem doing business with America, but we have to stop signing up to their imperialism. We have to stop signing up to the aggression that they bring. And that's something that I honestly believe that the European citizens want. And if the European Union that we are part of, if it doesn't change tight and if it doesn't look at actually addressing the treaties, there's going to be huge challenges there. And we were talking about Brexit. Obviously, the next big player that would be a threat to leave is Italy. Italy never really felt at home in the European Union. And the main reason being, Italy never really bought into globalization. Italy is an incredible country for innovation and for industry, but it's most of it is still family run. And you know what? In many ways, the European Union doesn't suit Italy. And it was interesting when they were giving out the COVID money, there was a 750 billion purse set aside to give to member states initially. There's nearly 2 trillion in total to be divvied out, but it's in different packages. But there was 750 billion and half of it was in grants and the other half was cheap loans, right? They gave the Italians nearly a third of it to keep them sweet. Because they know that Italy is not happy with the European Union. It's a bit happier with them now when they're getting that money, right? But that money won't last forever. And remains to be seen how the Italians divvy it out. And if that's not done in a fair manner, the problems won't be long coming back.
Thank you very much for being on the podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about your show? You've barely talked about it, where to find it, what you guys are working on, what's happening. All that stuff.
Well, I'd be the worst in the world to tell you where to find it.
Yeah, because not a singer. Where do you find it?
I am absolutely clueless about computers and everything like that. But it's called I Foresee Trouble with Daly and Wallace.
That's I, the number 4, and C.
Yeah. I'm sure it's...
You get it on all of these podcast app things and, Spotify and all or whatever. I don't know. These podcast apps that are out there, it's out there. But we have set up a group in the Irish Parliament. We're called Independence for Change. So I4C. So it's I4C Trouble with Daly and Wallace. And it's on any of the podcast apps. And we cover the work we do in the European Parliament. So if you want to hear the madness coming out of the mouths of the anti-China, anti-Russia brigade in here, we feature that strongly and we cover the work that we do here.
And if anyone is interested, we wrote a book together called The Coalition of the Unwilling, given that the Americans claimed it was the Coalition of the Willing that was illegally bombing half the planet at one stage. And we wrote a book called The Coalition of the Unwilling, and it's been sold by Connolly Books, who are a very good group. They're actually... It's the Communist Party of Ireland, and there's some great people involved with them, and they have a bookshop, so they're selling it at the moment. We still haven't launched the book because of COVID. We plan to do a bit of a launching tour in Ireland when COVID allows, but we haven't got there yet. But anyway, listen, the book is it's very much about a lot of what we're talking about Irish neutrality, about the militarization of Europe today. And obviously it was built around a court case where we spent 3 days in court because we were arrested for illegally entering the airport to search the US military plane. But we managed to turn the tables at court that we didn't get the judge's decision, but we put the Irish system, the Irish government's on trial, and we put US imperialism on trial. And the book will be, I think a lot of people will find it interesting.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mick. Thank you, Claire. Really appreciate your time.
No problem.
Thanks for having us. Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.